This is a new voice for a new Scotland.
Hello, good evening everyone, and welcome to the TNT show on Indie Live. My name is John Drummond, and I'm your host for the next 60 minutes. Thanks for joining us this evening. We have a special guest tonight that I know you will enjoy listening to. But first, a few words about TNT. TNT, of course, stands for The Nation Talks. So in many respects, this is your show. Now, we thank you in advance for your questions, but do remember, and this is important, please, that you can send questions live during the show. Ewan and I will try and answer as many as we possibly can. Now, without any further ado, on to our special guest, Ewan Hunter. Now, very, very few, let me assure you folks, can claim to have as varied a career as Ewan. He's a former pro snooker player and now a successful businessman and much else besides. Ewan, how are you this evening?
I'm very well, thank you, John, and thank you for such warm words as an introduction.
Honestly, I could have embellished it even further if I'd had time. But seriously, how are you coping with COVID-19?
So, like everybody, it was a huge jolt. I want to say shock, but I think given the news that we had seen coming from China and spreading west around the world, and when it got to Italy, by the time the impact hit here, I think like a lot of people, I was almost waiting for that to happen. And it had a big impact on my life, that of my family, of course, and my business. So, you know, profound. But I've spent the last few weeks working on a variety of different projects. I'm sure we'll talk about some of that tonight. And also tried to take the opportunity to look for some of the positives that have emerged from the opportunity to, you know, pause and take a fresh look at a number of things. So, yeah, notwithstanding the horrific experience of very many people across not just Scotland, wider UK, but right across the world, it's a period of reflection that I think none of us will probably ever get the chance to take part in again. So I've been mindful of all of that. But it's been an interesting last couple of months.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more shortly about your experiences of countries elsewhere and how they have responded to this hugely problematic situation that we're in. But let's begin at the beginning. Tell us a little bit about your career. What have you done? Where have you been? And what your experiences are?
So I suppose my first answer is, which career? So I graduated from Glasgow University with a degree in Scottish history. And I knew at the time I was very fortunate to have been there when two giants of Scottish history were handing over the baton to each other. So Professor Archie Duncan, or A.A.M. Duncan, as he is known on many of the books he wrote, was the chap who ran the Scottish History Department at Glasgow, and a significant reason actually why I wanted to go there. He retired and was replaced by Professor Ted Cowan, another giant of Scottish history. And I was fortunate enough to be taught by both of them. And my tutor, who I understand, I think is still there, Dovit Beroun, who was just an inspiring individual as well. So I graduated from Glasgow University having studied Scottish history, but been involved as people like me did with debating societies and anything I could kind of throw myself into. So I was involved in all of that, but I had a burning desire to enter the world of professional sport and in particular snooker, which had been a love of mine from a very young age. So I embarked on an ambitious plan to become a professional snooker player. I spent a year simply practicing and working hard. I had obviously been playing the sport since I was 7 years old, and for a couple of years prior to that, been playing pool in my granddad's. He'd had a pool table and he'd graduated to a full-size snooker table. When he had a pool table, I used to play on a couple of upturned tomato boxes. That was me. So late 70s. And of course, my interest in it coincided with my age, with the boom of snooker as a global sport. So, you know, just the re-emergence of Alex Higgins in the late 70s, early 80s, Steve Davis becoming dominant. And then, of course, Stephen Hendry becoming, you know, the most dominant player and the most successful player in the history of the sport. And, of course, Stephen Hendry, you know, came from down the road. So it felt very achievable and, you know, and something I still love the game. So I became a professional. I also became one of World Snooker's accredited coaches. There was only 40 of us in the world. And for that, I was trained by Terry Griffiths, Steve Davis, Ray Reardon, and I can name drop the snooker greats.
What were these guys really like?
You know, in the main, very like the characters you saw on the TV. There was very little in the way of wildly different persona. I just don't think that existed in the lexicon, if you like, of professional snooker. Dennis Taylor, actually, who people always reacted very warmly to, I have to say, there was a period of time where he and I were quite close, and just one of the warmest, nicest human beings you could ever meet. So we worked quite closely together. Being me, I got involved in a flashpoint in World Snooker, which some people might remember, when the world governing body was actually about to potentially split into two. But snooker as a global sport back around the turn of this century was, and still isn't, really big enough to cope with two global rival tours. So at the time I worked with Barry Hearn, who now actually effectively owns most of World Snooker. But he and I worked alongside Dennis Taylor and Steve Davis to really try to enable the sport to get its house in order. And I learned some really valuable lessons as a young man in my mid-20s about how you go through the process of both encouraging people to understand the realities of situations, and even in the most extreme cases, actually trying to enable turkeys to vote for an early Christmas, because it was literally the only way out at that time. So anyway, so I got involved, you know, with the world governing body, which was a really fascinating experience. Again, as I say, as a young man in my mid-20s, one of the players, but I was a bit different. There weren't a lot of graduate, especially, you know, Scottish history graduates kicking about on the snooker tour at the time. Anyway, so I moved on. I'd given myself 3 years to try to crack it. And, you know, I practiced with guys like John Higgins, Alan McManus occasionally. Chris Small and I were regular practice partners. And at the time, he was in the top 16 in the world as well. So, but I wanted to be in the top 64 in the world after three seasons. And if I wasn't, I was going to do something else. So I'd started also working part-time for a small headhunting business who were part of a European and Asian network. Long story short, we got acquired and subsumed back within a US business from which the roots of the European and Asian network had started, and we became the world's largest exec search business with 1,200 offices. But it was a franchise business, so it was 1,200 businesses around the world. But it was really, really good experience. I effectively learned the trade, if you will, around executive search or recruitment and headhunting with the business who can lay claim to starting it back in the 1950s in America and who really codified the process. So it gave me a great grounding, got me involved in lots of really interesting conversations with business leaders and with people who made decisions. And again, I always describe the parallel between having a degree in history and being a management consultant, which I guess is where I am now, as being a very similar path, because you've got to fundamentally be interested in what people do, why they do it, who they do it for. And it's much the same skills as anybody conducting any sort of investigative interest or being a bit of a nosy so-and-so, which is perhaps the simpler way to look at it. And you know, I'm interested.
How do you find the people? From time to time, I've been on the other side of it, where people have called me and said, "Are you entirely happy where you are, John?" To which my answer was, "Sorry, who are you?" it struck me that some of these folks are awfully good, i.e. that they could segue into some sort of description of that didn't leave you thinking, hey, this is all very odd, but rather it seemed terribly natural. And I was, we call lots of people lots of times, you know, you're just, but then other people would phone and say, no, we're looking for this particular person. I mean, I was a director with Honeywell. I used to get calls on a fairly frequent basis. Some of them were quite mixed and didn't inspire a lot of confidence, but others did, which is fascinating.
The secret is not a secret. It's about doing your homework. And that's where I've always felt that my degree in history was a really strong grounding. Because if you learn to research a topic, and if you learn to understand all the moving parts and all the constituent considerations that go into that, then you can start to build a picture of the sort of solution that's required. So if you decide, you know, that the particular brief requires somebody that is a very John Drummond-shaped hole, then you need to not only research the job and the business and talk to the company who you're working with, but you also need to understand the culture of the business if you're doing it really well, and then understand as much as you can about the culture of where the people who you think you're looking for work and exist as well. So it's a sort of multi-layered matrix bit of research, really, if you're doing it really well. The interesting thing is that you can do it at a really shallow level, which is the sort of experience that you've had at the other end of the spectrum, and take the view that you know, you're going to fling enough mud at the wall and some of it will stick.
Yeah.
But I find that you know, intellectually not the right way to do it, and morally and ethically, I just think it leaves a lot to be desired. So, you know, you piece together, it's a jigsaw. You piece together the jigsaw, and it's interesting.
Say for example, there was somebody watching tonight, and they wanted to move on and find a newer, better position. Very difficult at this particular time, but let's assume that the pandemic is over and somebody wants to make a move. How would you suggest they go about that? How do they get listed with you so that you might find a fit somewhere?
Headhunters will tell you this all the time. We get approached all the time by people saying, well, if you get a brief, keep me in mind. And in the nicest possible way, the best response I can say is, by all means, send a copy of your CV, that kind of thing. But the way it works is actually the other way around. We jump into action when a client employs us to go and get the right solution. If you're somebody looking for a job, then you're probably it's probably better for you to engage with the recruitment end of the market rather than the headhunter end of the market, because recruiters have typically a much more fluid and ongoing relationship with their clients. We tend to get activated or brought into play when organisations have that specific need. And in that moment, they need us to go and, you know, rifle shoot, if you like. It's about...
It's a Winchester, not a shotgun. I see how that would be the case. But how do you know where to go? Say I need a senior executive in marketing. And ideally, I would like that person to be on board yesterday.
Yep.
So there's no pressure. But it has to be the right sort of person, and it has to fit the culture of our company, and they have to get on with me, and I'm a real SOB. How do you put all that together? How do you not frighten the prospective candidate? I don't want to introduce you to my client because he's a real, what's it? I mean, so how do you handle all that?
So actually, the best way to do that is to ask if the client will basically let you under the skin of their business. In other words, get a chance to meet some of the people involved with the business, get a real sense of the culture, interview the people who are actually employed in the business. And if a client isn't up for engaging with you in those kind of ways, or allowing you access to understand enough about the culture of the business and understand how it operates, then that's a pretty big red flag about the kind of relationship you're going to have with them, and also the type of employer that they are. So I'm going to suggest that it's quite self-selecting, because organisations who want to engage with you and who get that, then will do so in that kind of way. If I could just offer one comment in answer to your question a moment ago about advice to people who maybe are looking for a job. In a sense, what I'd say is turn everything I've just said around the other way. In other words, do the real hard research on the business and the culture of that company. There's now a lot of really good things out there, like Glassdoor, where people will post their feelings about a business from within it in an anonymous way, and will build a picture of the culture. But I would be cautious about putting too much emphasis on any one particular source of information. So take a number of sources, build a picture about the culture of the type of business that you think you're applying to, and you know that will help. So again, turning it round, you know, my advice is where possible, if you are looking for another job and you have the luxury of time, then work out the types of organisation you want to work for, get on the internet, which is, you know, rich with all that information these days, and start looking up the kinds of places that exist within your geography doing the sort of stuff that you're interested in. And from there, you start filtering down into, that's the sort of place that talks the language that inspires me. And then, you know, make your approaches directly to people. You know, use things like LinkedIn, use things like Facebook, and go direct to people and say, I'm really inspired by what you do and I want to talk to you.
Okay, sounds great. I'm going to ask you a question about snooker and recruitment. Without necessarily getting into enormous detail, did you come across anyone in the snooker fraternity, leaving aside Barry Hearn, who clearly fits that description, who would be a great executive?
No, that's a very interesting question. It would depend on, I think, what you were looking for them to do.
Challenging then. Somebody who was a great human resources director.
Well, that's an even harder question, because without seeking to dodge it in any way, John, you know, it was 20 years ago that I was part of that fraternity. There was a number of really bright people. So I think that would be the first thing I would say. It's just that they had focused their intellect into, you know, into being a snooker player. You know, people like John Higgins, who's, you know, a clever guy. Ronnie O'Sullivan, interestingly, very sharp guy, and a really nice human being, irrespective of some of the headlines that he's attracted. Certainly my experience of him was that, you know, fundamentally, he was a nice guy, and he came from an interesting background. You know, so people like that, with a high degree of empathy, especially nowadays, would probably do pretty well in that world.
Okay, well, we might come back to that, but in the meantime, we've had a text message question. I don't have a name, I'm sorry, and I'm sorry, viewer, if we don't have your name on the text, but I'll press ahead anyway and ask, because it's an interesting question, and thank you for the question, and it's this. What do you think the future of work will look like for young people?
I think that is a fascinating question. And I guess fast forwards to my career right now, where, as I mentioned, I'm a management consultant more than anything. So I tend to spend a lot of my time working with organisations, not just in the talent acquisition space, so acquiring the right people, but a lot more of my time is now spent with organisations, helping them to develop and nurture that talent. I've worked over the last 10, 11 years, in a lot of areas around young people, because to my mind, the only way that we could see a future for any industry is not just to focus on, you know, senior leaders, but what that senior leader pool is coming from. So, you know, take that to the logical extension, and it is young people. And so, you know, I think we've got to create, as much as we have to create the right environment within organisations for people to succeed, we need to create the right environment as a nation for our young people to succeed. So in answering the question about what does the future of work look like for young people, well, I think it's a fast evolving space. I think we know that clearly the pandemic has accelerated a number of issues. One of the pieces of work I do is with a social enterprise called Get the Gen. We work with organizations to help them deliver intergenerational workshops and training and talks, mentor training and other consultancy solutions. So we deploy a number of tools to help organisations try to understand what the future of work for young people will look like, alongside how we integrate that into today's workforce. So future of work for young people, undoubtedly, this pandemic right now has enabled us all to work, it's forced us all to work more remotely, and it's enabled organisations to have to look at that change. And in many respects, we have compressed probably 3 to 5 years worth of change into about 2 months. So, you know, that's what we're facing right now. And I think for young people, it is a particularly difficult period because, of course, they have got to combat the expectations of many of their parents and older members of their family, with employers sometimes who find it quite tricky to also move at that sort of speed, and at the same time deal with this very fast, ever-changing world. So what will it look like? It'll look more flexible. It'll look hopefully more tolerant, hopefully more integrated, and hopefully more equitable.
Do you think there'll also be a change in attitudes? I mean, for example, you work across different cultures, yep, and we'll talk about Vietnam and other Estonia and other countries in a second, perhaps, but you work across different cultures, and my experience of spending a lot of time in the States, for example, was there was a big cultural difference I had to come to terms with, because I came from a Scottish background, and all of a sudden I found myself in an environment where, well, the most striking thing of all was that people didn't recognise failure. I mean, I kept bumping into people who were successful but had failed time after time after time.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, gracious, this is an odd culture where nobody seems to feel any shame, really, attaching to falling over. Their only question about falling over was attached to how quickly can I get up, rather than having some great angst about why me. It was all about how do I effect a recovery and make lots of money. Not just money, but also make an impact in society generally. I mean, for example, take the case of Ray Kroc, long before my time in the States, but he was a failed soda fountain salesman and he became a billionaire, because one of his clients in California was a couple of brothers who ran a hugely successful hamburger joint called McDonald's. And he sold more of his soda stuff into McDonald's than any other customer. And he couldn't understand why. And it was because people were queued up around the block. And he thought, what's so special about them, their hamburgers compared to everyone else? And of course, he then took over the business, kept the name McDonald's, and we are where we are today. So do you think there's a cultural thing at work there as well?
I think, I mean, you've touched on lots of different factors, but fundamentally, culture is enormous. There are good bits of cultures from all over the world that people can share and learn from. And I think one of the interesting challenges, especially with the mediums of, you know, the internet that we have, we're talking through it right now, is that it's awful easy to fall into the hole of a quasi-homogenous culture, actually. And so there's a lot of challenges around getting the culture right, particularly when you're working with organisations. But the other thing that I think is always really important is that people have to recognise that you can deliberately affect and change culture. And that is something that often comes as a bit of a surprise to people. You know, if you describe culture, it's, well, it's the way we do things around here. Yeah, okay, fine. But you can change that. Well, I suppose so, but maybe nobody stopped to ask that question. So, you know, working with organizations around the world, as I have, yes, culture is a massive thing, both within the organization, but within the part of the world that they exist. So, you know, I've done work with organizations in the States. I've worked with companies in Thailand. I've worked with companies in Germany, Moscow. You know, you do have to have that cultural sensitivity, I think, first and foremost. But then that just allows you to ask the questions and get to build your understanding. And if you're curious in the right way, then, you know, you just continue to absorb and learn so much. And there's bits of cultures, as I say, around the world that I think we can all share and learn from, and for lots of reasons. But, you know, it's something that I know you share a love of, as I do, John. Really, this is all about the stories that we tell each other, the building blocks that go into creating these stories. And I think that's a fundamental part of the human condition. So I want to celebrate different cultures around the world. I want people to be proud of their cultures and, you know, make the most of all the good things. At the same time, there's good ways to learn from each other without necessarily, as I say, assimilating into one homogenous culture, because I think actually that would be a shame. And really, the world would be a poorer place if we just assimilated into one dominant kind of culture. So I like the fact that we've got differences, and I want to celebrate that.
Probably, I think most people would go along with that. I mean, you could perhaps reduce it to joy and diversity or some such term. We've had a question from Ian Leckendy. He's asking, what about entrepreneurs? Or yep. More specifically, the definition of work over the last 30 years?
I work with a number of entrepreneurs. I've started a few businesses. I've been handed that label myself a few times. I think his second point about what about the definition of work over the last 30 years is a really interesting point. We could open up this discussion into the whole discussion around universal basic income, around how we react to, you know, all sorts of environmental changes as a society and what we do. But you know, you mentioned some of the other cultures that I've been doing work in and presenting a new show ourselves called Scotland Calling. And in that, we are talking to people all around the world, and we are trying to understand, you know, how they're getting on in this current crisis. And the reason I mention that is that Estonia is one of the nations. That was our first episode that we released. And Estonia is a country with 1.3 million people. So it's, you know, one fifth the size of Scotland. And you know, it's described to me in no uncertain terms that everybody in Estonia has a side hustle. So everybody is an entrepreneur. And that is just part of their culture. They have a job, but they think that's fine, that pays the bills. And it's just widely accepted that I'll be doing something else, which will be interesting. And that other thing might be the thing that is my golden ticket, but it might not, because who knows? But let's have a go anyway.
It's funny that you say that, because my experience of Vietnam, I was only there for a couple of 3 weeks, but my sense of it was energy. Now, I know that the vast bulk of the population, you correct me if I've got this wrong, is under 30.
Yeah, 75% are under 30, which gives them a demographic, it's like a demographic tidal wave that they're riding on the top of.
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, the essence of what I gathered from Vietnam was energy. I mean, everywhere I went, there were people doing things.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the things that we're doing were just crazy. But traveling south from Hanoi and passing factory after factory after factory, all new, spanking new, because China had proved to be too expensive and multinationals were just moving and stuff. And we could talk about that and the morality of all of that. And I'd love to do that. But I suspect we don't have time tonight to do that. We have another question. I suspect I know the answer to this as far as I'm concerned, but I'd love to hear it from you. And it's from John Nicholson on YouTube. And he's asking, do you feel safe with Boris in charge?
I think that is a really interesting question. And if I just tie that back into your comments there a little about Vietnam, because it proves a really interesting juxtaposition. Vietnam is a country of 97 million people. They have registered just under 300 cases of COVID-19. It has a land border with China. Its biggest trading partner is China. It relies on that trade for a very substantial part of its economy. They have had zero deaths in this current pandemic. Now, Vietnam is a different society. It's constructed entirely differently from the way that we are constructed, both in Scotland, but also just, I guess, in the broader Western world. However, when they went to lockdown, they went early. They acted ahead of World Health Organization advice on practically every front. And they simply followed the logic. And to make that even more profound, they had a guy in charge who had never looked after the health care brief within the government at all. And so he was a new guy. Now, you know, that's proven to be a really interesting case because he was able to be led by the expertise and had to rely on the expertise of others. And, you know, you and I know from our business careers, John, that the some of the most effective leaders are the ones who devolve that responsibility as far as they can go. People step up, they feel, you know, hugely enabled by that responsibility and trusted, and therefore the trust goes both ways. And from a distance, that looks very much like a lot of what has happened in Vietnam. Now, as I say, there are structural differences and societal differences that are very, very profound. But in answering John's question about feeling safe with Boris in charge, the answer has to be no. And, you know, again, you know, we look at other organisations, other countries around the world of a very similar size to Scotland. We've been doing lots of conversations, and I think it's going to be a fascinating episode. I don't want to big it up too much, but when Scotland Calling New Zealand comes out, I think everybody will be really interested in that. And there's a country with virtually the same population as Scotland, and they have had, I checked earlier on this afternoon, I think a total of 21 deaths, which is terrible for everybody involved. But at the same time, 21 deaths is nothing in comparison to the equivalents, you know, in the UK. And so New Zealand doesn't have nuclear weapons. It has a law in place that bans nuclear weapons from within 200-mile radius of New Zealand. And that law is not even up for debate by either left or right. It's just a way of being. It is good. And when I look, so I guess the reason I mention that is that in answering John's question, I look to the bigger picture, the wider world. And as Scotland finds itself right now, our place in that wider world is not something that we can decide. And as a consequence of that, I think there are dangers that face us that shouldn't. I think clearly Nicola Sturgeon has been doing a very good job as First Minister within the confines of what's capable of the devolved settlement that Scotland finds itself. But I think it's clear the job she would do and the Scottish Government would do were it able to take the actions that any other normal nation around the world, New Zealand, Denmark, Norway, all of the same sort of size, then we would be in a far stronger position on a whole host of fronts.
Great, super, a great answer. Thank you very much. I thought for a minute you were going to take the Boris Johnson response and just dodge the question completely by saying, what makes you think that Boris is in charge?
I did cross my mind that the answer would be, he isn't, it's Dominic Cummings. But
exactly, Dominic Cummings, yes. A question on Facebook from Sharon Gallagher. Interesting point this, because I think a lot of people might be thinking this. Taking you back to Estonia, her point is, how many of these folks who have a second job, in inverted commas, are doing that through choice, or, as happens in this country, the necessity to have three or four jobs just to get by?
I think Sharon makes a really interesting point, and I think a really important point, actually. So the answer is that, again, their society and systems are structured differently. But in the main, it is out of choice rather than necessity when we look at places like Estonia. And there's one big fundamental part of that, which is something that is very often overlooked, but came out loud and clear from the conversations we were having with Estonia. So when Estonia rediscovered its independence in the early 90s from the dissolution of the USSR, they had a very much a greenfield site in some respects in terms of how they set themselves up. One of the key things that they put in place during that period was a pension system and a pension support that didn't matter to you whether you're working for private companies or for the public sector. You basically carry that pension with you wherever you go. So it means that people will move from what we would regard as government or local authority jobs into private sector jobs, working with entrepreneurs, being entrepreneurs, going back to the public sector. That is a very much more fluid environment. And one of the biggest barriers we have to that here is the fact that a lot of people work in jobs where they get to a stage in life, dare I say it, those perhaps in their mid-40s or above, for whom pension considerations start to become very, very significant. So it becomes a huge disincentive here to move. And indeed, actually, it becomes, on a lot of practical levels, impossible for people to move because they can't necessarily go from working in a local authority into being working in an entrepreneurial environment. But equally, culturally, we would find that, you know, highly unusual because people typically spend, you know, longer in either public sector or private sector, and there's not nearly as much crossover. So in answer to Sharon's question, from what we understand from what I know, more of that is out of choice than necessity. And as I say, one of the key enablers of that is the fact that they have a very much more fluid approach to, you know, how they build an economy and where people's skills come from. The consequence is it's in many respects a very dynamic economy, and certainly in technological terms it's very dynamic.
I think, yeah, thank you for that. That's hopefully Sharon found that helpful. A quick question which occurs is that you said that Estonia, the nation of Estonia in its present form, occurred on the dissolution or dismemberment of the Soviet Union. How did that happen in practical terms? I mean, did they have a referendum? Did they produce a constitution? Or did they just say, hey, we're Estonians now and live with it?
So it was the singing revolution in Estonia. And it was a very strong, popular cultural movement whereupon they did have a vote. They did enact a constitution, as I understand it, in order to give a framework to the re-emergent nation of Estonia. But like a lot of countries, and I'm not a Estonian historian, if I can say that. But from our research, you know, you learn a few things. But like a lot of countries, it has a very long history. It's just got a very long and checkered history of how it's regarded, internationally. And there was a period of time where it was regarded as an independent state, but, you know, in the 1920s, early 20s, so after the First World War, right up to the start of the Second World War. And then it became part of the Soviet Union during that Second World War phase up until the very early 90s. But in some respects, they then took the opportunity to say, OK, well, we've got a green field. Let's get this right. Let's do what we can. Let's put the framework in here. And part of that meant really investing in, you know, the way they could in making everything as digital as possible. So there's virtually nothing you can't do digitally. And from the age of 8 to 80, people will go online, and it's normal in Estonia to go online to, you know, have a consultation with your doctor and order your repeat prescription, for example. But that's just what happens. And it doesn't matter what age you are. There's nothing weird about that. That's just what happens. But the point is, if you just think of the efficiencies within every single interaction that can bring, then it's no wonder that they have become, you know, the fastest growing economy in the EU. They are now a member of the UN Security Council. That's a seat at the very top table of UN decision making. And this is a nation of 1.3 million people. So, you know, there's a lot of lessons in there for Scotland. And I think there's a lot more inspiration, actually. But again, they have challenges. They are far more reliant on fossil fuels, for example, than we are. They are, along with China, the world's largest producers of shale oil. So, you know, they rely heavily on that for their energy needs. So I think in terms of some of the green tech that Scotland is playing a leading role in, you know, there's a lot we can share and learn from each other.
Good. Well, that sounds very positive. Now, let's move on to the referendum, because we've only got just 15 minutes left, and I want to task you on your views on where you think we are in terms of a referendum. I mean, do you think there's going to be a Section 30? And if you think it's going to happen, is it going to happen anytime soon? What's your sense of this?
So I think that's a fascinating question. I do think there will be a Section 30. The process for achieving that, I think, remains one that to some extent is a little unclear. However, I think, you know, clearly it highlights one of the fundamental weaknesses within the British constitution, i.e. that there isn't a constitution, and that, you know, we are in a place where we've got to try to enable the Section 30 to happen as best we can without recourse to constitutional arrangements like many, many other countries, most other countries around the world, frankly. In answer to your question, do I think there'll be one? Yes. Do I think it'll happen anytime soon? I, the old phrase, a week is a long time in politics, springs to mind regularly. And I think for those who are watching that are supportive of Scottish independence, my view would be ready at a moment's notice and keep working hard for advancing, you know, that cause every single day, because we don't know when the opportunity will come to enable that to happen. But I do think it will happen, because I think ultimately UK government's insistence on it not happening it was untenable to start with, and it just gets weaker by the day. But I also am sensitive to the views that there's little in the way of leverage that we have on our own right now to force that. But I think bigger events, you know, while we're living through one right now, and the fallout of this, we don't know where it will be. But I do think there will be opportunities for in future and, you know, not too distant future for that case to be made, and for Scotland to, you know, take its place back as part of the member of the global community.
Okay, so in short, we should look out for a tipping point at some stage, perhaps.
And I might ask the question back to you, John. You know, what's your sense of timing?
We've only got just about 10 minutes, so once I got started on this, we wouldn't be able to fit into 10 minutes. But I'll say very briefly, because it's a very good question. It's as the party company from Westminster, and they weren't all that varied. They just started acting as if they were independent in a lot of cases. Yeah. And Westminster decided not to contest. And the great value to independent countries in an unwritten constitution, i.e. living under the control of an unwritten constitution, is that there are no specific boundaries. No, once you make the move, there is no piece of legislation that says you may not. There is no, for example, as there are in many countries, a prohibition on secession. And unlike the Spanish constitution, geographical integrity of the UK, it's not written down anywhere. It's rather assumed. But then again, assumptions are, as you know, say, makes an ass out of you and me, as they say in business sometimes. We're getting close to the end now. I've got 10 minutes to go. I can't let you go without asking you about Sarah Smith. What's your take on this situation? No doubt you saw the broadcast last night.
Yeah, well, it continues to paint itself into corners. And, you know, situations like the one last night where, for anybody who didn't see it, Sarah Smith described the First Minister as enjoying her moment of difference between Scotland and Westminster. I would say a couple of things. Firstly, that I think that it was clearly a crass error on behalf of Sarah Smith. I saw that she followed it up with a form of an apology. I would be interested to see if that apology is then repeated on air. And I think I would like to see that be the case. At the same time, I note that the First Minister has accepted that apology and has said she's very happy to move on. So, you know, that would be my approach. At the same time, I think it certainly belies a lack of sensitivity to how how people feel in Scotland about, you know, where we are and where we find ourselves and the gravity of the situation. And I don't think that cheap remarks of the type that Sarah Smith made were in any way helpful to anybody, actually. So as I say, on reflection, I think it was an unedifying episode yet again for the BBC, and you know they have the opportunity to put it right, and I think that should be done on screen. I'm not going to hold my breath, but there does need to be some context for this. And again, I'm conscious of time, John, but I was in a discussion a number of years ago with Ian McWhirter, a well-known journalist, who made the point, and this is even about 4 or 5 years ago, that if Scotland had its proportionate share of cost into an independent BBC Scotland, then the budget for BBC Scotland would be of the order of £320 million a year. And the budget at that time for BBC Scotland was £80 million roughly per year and going down. So, you know, so there's a number of structural issues within the BBC, and I think, without wanting to broaden it too much, I suppose, Sarah Smith peeled the lid back on that again in a wholly unnecessary and partisan way. But I would refer to Drummond's Law and ask you to tell listeners who perhaps haven't seen it what that is.
Well, it's people can see it on social media, but it essentially what it says is that in extremis, BBC's Scotland can behave pretty much as it likes, because even if every single person in Scotland deplored its output, it could still continue because its democratic oversight, the democratic control, lies outside this country. So therefore, it, again, in extremis, it need not be fussed or concerned about the reaction of its consumers, because decisions about its future will not be made by them, but by others. And that seems to me to be very, very unfortunate, choosing my words carefully here. And I have to say, unsustainable, because it is a democratic affront that a major so-called public sector broadcaster experiences no democratic oversight in the country where it operates. That would be unacceptable in Westminster terms, and therefore it should not be acceptable in Scottish terms.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, one thing I would say is, knowing a number of people who either have, or you know, in very recent times or less recent times, worked within the BBC, there are, you know, a lot of very good people working there who do a very good job, who go in every day just to do a really good job and focus on the bit that they're doing. And, you know, and I think, I think it's a shame that, in a sense, they end up in a place and in a sort of perception, a situation where the perception of the work they do is perhaps not given the credit that it deserves.
I think that's a good point. And I think the reputation of a brand or an entity or an organisation, the responsibility for the sustenance and upkeep of that rests squarely on the shoulders of the top management team. And it's very sad to see that it would appear that they are not quite up to the task. Thank you very much, Ewan. This has been hugely entertaining. We've managed to fit in a whole bunch of questions from Ian and from Sheila and from others. And I thank you sincerely for giving up your time. And it's greatly appreciated. It sounds like my time's almost up as well. A big thank you for joining us. And a big thank you to everyone watching and listening to the show tonight. I hope you've enjoyed it. We have a formidable list of guests lined up for future shows, and you can join us next Tuesday at 7 p.m. for another exciting offering, and I hope you'll do that. In the meantime, do look out for my Constitution column in the Sunday National this weekend, and more importantly, support Indie Live and Indie Live Radio. New voices for a new Scotland and for all the news you're not getting. And let me mention one last thing before I go, and that is we're hoping to speak with Martin J. Keatings tomorrow about the people's action on Section 30. And you may know that Lady Poole found in favour of the motion that the case ought to proceed, and that both the Scottish and UK governments will have until the 20th of May to lodge their basic assumptions, with an eight-week adjustment period thereafter before it appears again in court. So that's something to look forward to. Hopefully we can do that tomorrow. But do join us next Tuesday. Absolutely confident it will be as exciting as it was tonight. I hope you feel that we've responded well to your questions. If you like the show, let us know. If you don't like the show, more importantly, let us know, because we want to improve. You've heard what Ewan has so eloquently described tonight about organisations that succeed. They grow by listening to their customers, and not, as some unfortunate organisations we've talked about tonight, not by ignoring their customers. We don't want to ignore you. We want to listen to you. We want to do what you think is best in growing the show and making it more and more about what you want. After all, this is The Nation Talks. Thanks again. A big thank you to you and Hunter, and good night to you all.
This is A New Voice for A New Scotland.
And in life, God, radio.